Good evening, and welcome to Outsources, a weekly KGNU program that provides you with content by and for queer communities in Colorado. I'm your host, Sean Kenny, and tonight's show focuses on the lived realities of queer and trans people currently incarcerated.
Hi, my name is Jessica Phoenix Sylvia. I'm currently incarcerated in the Washington State Prison System.
That's Jess, a trans woman living in a men's prison who is currently working to collectively organize for trans rights and transformative justice. I got connected with Jess through Empowerment Avenue, which helps connect outside organizations and individuals with writers, artists, musicians, and thinkers who are incarcerated. Jess and I originally started talking via JPay, a for-profit email system used for communication with incarcerated people. We then spoke on the phone through another for-profit prison call system. Earlier this month, Jess called me from prison specifically to record the following conversation. She started off talking about the work she's engaged in broadly, before going into more detail about the Gender Identity Justice Campaign, which she's spearheading in support of trans people who are incarcerated.
I do a lot of different work. Really, I would consider myself to be an activist. I'm an abolitionist, and I'm also a writer. I'm involved with a lot of different groups, and in here in the prison, we have an LGBTQ group called Alliances, which is really a support group, and we do a lot of enrichment education, and we're also associated with other groups such as Compass Housing Alliance, looking at, you know, doing some different research on low-income and no-income housing for folks who are experiencing incarceration and trying to reenter. I'm also involved with University Behind Bars, and I'm currently an undergraduate student here in the prison. I'm involved with Disability Rights Washington Trans in Prison Justice Project, which is affecting a lot of positive change for access, for healthcare, housing decisions that are gender-affirming, and more humane searches and property and allowables for trans folks. And so one of the things that I have done is being a consult, sort of, you know, for the attorneys that are working to affect this change. I'm working with No New Washington Prisons, which was formerly No New Women's Prisons, but since we won that battle and there's no new women's prison being built, it's switched now to No New Washington Prisons. I'm also doing some other work, and I'm working with a wonderful organization called Empowerment Avenue, and I've recently begun to publish, and I've got a couple of contracts that I was recently offered. So now I'm bringing writing into the work.
So you're a very busy person, and I wonder if you could actually hone in on something that you have, that you're championing right now, which is the Gender Identity Justice Campaign. Can you talk a little bit about what that is and what you're seeking to do with that?
Yeah, thanks so much for bringing that up, Sean. So I do so much work. At this time, I've started something called the Gender Identity Justice Project. One of the issues is, look, as a trans prisoner, the erasure of trans identities is a very real thing. You know, I had a little bit of help, and I actually had a legal name change while I've been in prison. I've actually been incarcerated for a long time, for over 17 years, and I didn't have access to a lot of things when I was out there due to poverty, just the times. I didn't have access to certain health care and things like name changes. So I've had actually a legal name change. I've navigated the court system, done everything I need to do. I actually had people go to court for me to be there. And then I've even had my birth certificate, my Washington State birth certificate, amended to include that new name and even my gender marker so that it actually reflects my female identity. So I've had all that stuff to do, so it's official. And then I found out that the Washington Department of Corrections actually does not honor legal identity document changes. So essentially they're telling me that not only was I sentenced as a male, in 2005, I was sentenced to be a male, essentially, until my sentence is over. And what it really means for me objectively is it means that not only am I forced to wear an ID card that has my old dead name or my birth name, which, of course, I no longer use, but my male name is actually on all my documents. It means that people have to communicate with me by that old dead name, including my friends and family. It means even, you know, I actually had medical treatment yesterday, and I'm classified as a post-transition transgender woman, and even those documents have my old dead name on them and say that my gender is male. So, with that being said, what we're looking at is a systemic issue where all Washington State trans prisoners are dealing with this. So, what I'm looking at doing is trying to affect systemic change. Now, there are certain laws in place that actually say that Washington State may choose to force prisoners to use their incarcerated name for the duration of their sentence. But the wording is may, so it means that they actually have a choice. They could actually do the right thing and respect trans identities. They're just choosing not to. It appears that it's a way of, you know, deflecting criticism. They're saying that, look, this law is in place and we can't, which isn't true, again. So the Gender Identity Justice Campaign is meant to try to promote respect for trans identities, which includes a person's, of course, their gender presentation, you know, gender pronouns, and, of course, their name. So that's one of the things that I'm trying to do. And it's a grassroots campaign. So this isn't something that's just coming from an organization and it's hierarchical. This is a grassroots campaign, and this is something that we really believe in, that if people just decide that they believe in something, it takes a small action on everyone's part, and we can actually affect change. And you can actually get a little bit more information about this if you follow me on Twitter at AbolitionJeff.
Yeah, and so that's a way for people to get plugged into what you're doing and those articles that are going to be coming out soon that you mentioned as well. And this is coming in the midst of a lot of things happening, right? You recently had a settlement agreement with some of the trans and disability justice work that you're doing as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I think I spoke on this a little bit. So the Disability Rights Washington Group has a trans and prison justice project, and there's some attorneys that have been working on a settlement agreement with the Washington State Department of Corrections. And I think that a lot of what's going on with previously with California and the Ninth Circuit courts have dictated what should be happening. And so there's a lot of resistance by the Department of Corrections, and generally these type of law enforcement institutions are rightist by nature and are thought to be sort of strongholds of oppression, resistance for, you know, humanization of trans people. Well, what's happened is, under the threat of litigation, we've actually secured things such as, you know, property for trans folks, such as myself. We have cosmetics available, for instance, for trans women, even in the male facilities. So the searches have been updated a little bit so that, generally speaking, if it's available, I can opt out and not have a male officer possess my body in a search, and that I might feel more comfortable being searched by a female, for instance. We've done things such as healthcare is available. I'm actually approved now for gender-affirming surgery, and I'm awaiting a consult with a surgeon at this time. So we've got trans folks accessing hormones. We've got these medical interventions that are available. I actually just had my first laser hair removal appointment yesterday. So these are things, again, that the Department of Corrections are not giving us. These are things that under threat of litigation, the courts have decided we have a right to the same sort of health care that folks in the community are getting. So we're starting to get that. And then the last thing is gender-affirming housing. And we've actually had some trans folks, trans women, go to the women's institution recently. For me, I've decided I'm not going until I can take my name with me, because the irony here is that, look, trans women are going to the women's facility for housing. However, they're still going with their dead names.
This is just incredible. I think the dehumanization that you're talking about in terms of these kind of laws, and that, just as you said, when you're sentenced, you know, to prison, you're also sentenced a gender effectively for the duration of the time that you're in prison. And I think another thing that I just want to call out here is that this is also coming at a time when there are a lot of misinformation coming out around, you know, for example, trans women being in women's prisons, and, you know, folks spreading misinformation or demonizing trans women to kind of stoke fear around that. Is that right? And how have you kind of encountered that as you're fighting for some of these issues around women to access being in women's prisons?
Yeah, so that's interesting. Now, one of the things that, you know, we can see also in the news is that we've got all these anti-trans laws, and we'll see that there are folks who want to hide behind certain agendas. They say that, you know, they can attack trans kids and say that they're even protecting, say, women's sports or girls' sports. There is a lot of demonization happening. Now, the thing about housing trans women is, the way that we can say that folks are going over there now is that the policy has changed to where it's a lot easier for someone who is trans to get to the women's institutions. And unfortunately, one of the things that has happened is we've actually had false reports. Even recently, there was a show by a guy who's really transphobic, who actually, his name is Don Munson, and he has a radio show. And he actually has been sanctioned, even in the past, lost Seattle Seahawks advertising due to transphobic conduct and comments. Well, he's at it again, and actually had an anonymous DOC employee say that women are under attack, and there are these trans women or men who are going to the women's institution, and all the women are in danger, and actually made a, you know, accusation that someone was sexually assaulted, which is completely false, and I'll tell you why. And the way that we can say that that's completely false is because, you know, you can do a public disclosure on this and find that there is absolutely no reports of sexual assault. There is no evidence of anyone even making that accusation. However, there was one infraction that was written for two people kissing, consensually. So that's something that's happening right now. And there's actually a sign-on letter that trans folks and folks in the community are working on to get this guy fired, Don Munson. I think you can learn more about it at by contacting No New Washington Prisons online. And this is something that I believe in. It's another way that we can try to stand up for trans folks, because, again, trans folks are being demonized, and we're just trying to live our lives.
Yeah. Now, I know in the past, I think, what was it, few or maybe 4 years, you decided to be more public and visible, right, about being trans, being outspoken on gender justice issues. Can you speak a little to why that was? What caused that shift for you as you tried to do this justice and advocacy work?
Yeah. You know, Sean, part of it is throughout my life, I'd done a lot of things to try to please other people. And early in life, as I came out to my family even, I had a lot of negative images, a lot of negative messages about myself being put out there through religion, through my family, through society, the state. There weren't a lot of positive images about trans people. And you would hear things in the media, and they were generally, you know, really demonizing. And you would see representations of trans folks, even like, say, in Silence of the Lambs, and there would be some cross-dressing psychopath. And so I learned eventually that if trans folks are silent about who they are and do not take an active role in trying to transform the world, then, you know, we'll end up unintentionally internalizing oppression. And when folks internalize oppression and sort of these normative standards and these messages that society is putting out there, it turns into self-oppression. And the only way to combat that is for us to not allow others to define who we are, but we have to define who we are, and we have to be true to ourselves and live out our values. And part of that means not being silent. And I would say silence is violence. And the reason for that is if we're not taking, again, an active role in transforming the world, then we're going to continue to live under oppression. Now, I can also say that it's a difficult thing to do, and it took me a long time to get there. I think I was 40 years old by the time I had really gotten to that point where I was able to do what I felt I needed to do to stand on my own 2 feet and face the world if need be, and live by my values. So I'm really on a mission to try to make sure that the world is a better place for not only myself as an individual, but collectively for other people who aren't as strong as I am and who can't really stand up the way that I do, and generationally. And when I say generationally, I don't mean so that it's easier for other people to live in a cage, because, of course, I am an abolitionist, and the point is to try to get rid of prisons. They shouldn't exist. However, for the time being, there are people surviving living in a cage, and we need to try to get them out as undamaged as we can, right, to try to help them survive, and even beyond prison. And I think that one of the things that we can also learn is when people can even organize from a prison cell, we can do it in the community, and we can model that, and we can help each other. And one of the things that I would say is, hey, if you're a trans person, figure out what support you need and ask somebody to support you. And if you know a trans person, be intentional and ask them what you can do to support them. Thank you.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Outsources on KGNU. I'm your host, Sean Kenny, and we're listening in on my conversation with Jessica Phoenix Sylvia, a trans woman currently incarcerated in a men's prison. In the latter half of our conversation, Jess goes into more detail about her experiences with collective organizing for transformative justice and mutual aid. You've mentioned collective organizing, and it's so clear to me that, you know, doing this work collectively with others is so key to how you're approaching these issues. Can you just speak a little bit more to what collective organizing looks like for you, given the constraints of being in prison? I know you mentioned the Alliances group, the LGBTQ group, but how have you engaged in collective organizing, and what have you learned about collective organizing in this work?
Yeah, so, trans folks who are in prison are very isolated and vulnerable. You know, we experience generally higher rates of suicide and experience sexual violence actually at a rate of 13 times higher than other prisoners. So I think that one of the things I can say about this area in Western Washington, in the Seattle area, is we have some really great folks who reach into the prisons. And I would say that, you know, folks who are involved in different universities, such as the University of Washington or Seattle Central College, you know, and other folks who just want to get involved and through different organizations reach in and sort of...
You have 60 seconds remaining.
Oh, wow. Now we know who's in charge, don't we? So should I call you back?
At this point, you can hear our conversation is interrupted by a notification from the prison phone system, saying that our call will be shut off in 60 seconds, serving as a further reminder of the dehumanizing conditions under which Jess lives and organizes. We agree to try a second phone call, at which point Jess continues the conversation about how she views and practices collective organizing.
So the collective work that we do in here is with folks in the community, largely. However, you know, and looking at these different organizations, whether it's, like I said, Alliances, there are other groups in here such as the Latin Development Organization, the Black Prisoners Caucus, where, you know, a lot of growth happens with the outside volunteers and the prisoners inside. What I'm looking at also at this time is I'm actually looking at doing some other things within those constructs of these, you know, organizations, because we can't do any unauthorized gathering. The prisons are very, very restrictive, right? So in looking at doing some of the work that I would like to do is more restorative justice, transformative justice, community accountability type of work. So looking at installing restorative and transformative values and processes so that folks don't feel that they have to rely on the state. And I think it's a bit counterintuitive to be locked up by the state and then be told that we're supposed to depend on the state to keep us safe. Now, generally what happens is if harm is done, of course, you know, the state doesn't do anything to actually meet the needs of the person harmed. They just find out, well, who's the guilty party, and then harm them as well. And then you've got two harmed parties. So we're looking at restorative practices to not only hold people accountable for the harm that they do, but to meet the needs of people who are harmed, and then to build communities that have the skills to do that. So we're building communities and having supports and training people on these processes and trying to do that type of collective work. You know, it's so important for people to understand the collective is there to nurture the individual, and people have to have the room to be individuals. Otherwise, we have fascism. And then in turn, the individual must in some way feel like they want to contribute to a collective, or we'll have nothing. And, you know, if individuals all contribute, think how much we'll be winning if there's enough care to go around. And then what we're doing is we're changing culture, and it turns into generational change, too. So it's so important for people to understand, look, we can do collective work. And it all starts with individuals who are equipped and reaching out and taking the initiative to do that and say that, you know what, these are my communities, these are my people, and I'm going to do something about it.
I think what you're talking about in terms of like instituting transformative justice, community accountability in the communities where you're at, in the prison you're housed in right now, is such a powerful notion. And I'm wondering, I mean, can you speak just a little more about what that looks like, what you've learned and what it means to build or to practice a community accountability, especially when harm is caused, because it seems like you're building alternative ways of doing community care, you know, that might someday ideally replace the kinds of prisons that you're in right now, right? So can you speak just a little bit more to what that's looked like as you put that into practice?
Yeah, I sure can. And I would just say, you know, starting when we're talking about the retributive model that we're used to, you know, meaning that, of course, when, you know, someone is harmed, we're trained. We're actually not educated. We're actually trained. We're domesticated. And we're modernized to depend on the police instead of actually cultivating the mutual aid instinct that is within us, that even animals have within them. And the great sociologist, I believe in the 19th century, Peter Kropotkin, actually did a study called Mutual Aid, that we have this instinct that we actually want to care for each other. It's very simple. Even if our neighbor's house is on fire, even if we don't like them, we're going to help them, of course. However, we need to cultivate this instinct more and be less dependent on professionals to rescue us. And looking at cultivating this and looking at cultivating resiliency also, and let's just remember that the systems that this country has built and we've depended on really are colonial systems, and they only work well for certain people. They haven't traditionally worked for people who are in poverty or lower class, people who are, you know, women and non-white folks. So if we look at more indigenous practices and we look at different ways with communities dealing with harm and relying on each other, that's when we're looking at transformative justice and restorative practices that, you know, build communities that are equipped, such as if I have a support system around me, I can try to build, say, folks who I can turn to when I've caused harm and I've messed up, and I can go to folks and say, look, I messed up. What are we going to do about this? Or there's folks that I can go to when I know that I've been harmed and I can say, hey, I need help. And then we can also train each other and help each other on what it looks like to be there for a friend when they've been harmed, or to be there to hold a friend accountable when they've messed up. Because look, calling the police, traditionally, I know for my people, being a trans person of color with my indigenous and Latinx background, usually doesn't go too well. And I even had, when I was arrested, the police said that they would have shot me if they'd had a clear shot. And I was unarmed. So if you look at the statistics, actually say that 1/3 of all people who are killed by a stranger in this country are killed by the police. So I don't want to call the police. I don't feel like that's an answer for me or for my community. I feel like what needs to happen is community accountability processes. And these processes are not new. There are women of color. There are a lot of folks who traditionally do not function well and who are not served well by the retributive model of justice, who are working on brilliant solutions, and they're working. And it's not a one-size-fits-all. It's not just a replacement system where there's one process and that's it. It can look different for different communities. And I would just make sure that we reach out for the resources for transformative justice, restorative justice, community accountability. What does that look like? And it looks different for every community, whether we're talking about communities of color, we're talking about queer communities, we're talking about depending on ability. You know, it's going to look different for different people, and we should accept that and try to move towards that model, because it's about social sustainability, and we understand what environmental sustainability looks like. We have to remember, we can't just have people picked up like trash and thrown in a prison like a landfill and think that the problem is going to be solved. We know it doesn't work well environmentally. Why can't we figure that out, you know, in terms of social sustainability? And we need to be responsible for our communities. Unfortunately, we know that the burden is, you know, difficult, because we're all surviving capitalism and we're all very busy trying to pay our bills. So systemically, it's difficult, but we got to figure out a way to do it.
And this is sort of what you're talking about when you define yourself as an abolitionist, right? And so obviously with some of the work you're doing around the Gender Identity Justice Project, you're, you know, looking at how do we take care of people who happen to be in cages right now. But the broader priority of abolition is kind of on the horizon for you. Can you say a little bit more about, and I think you've basically already kind of nodded to this, but just what abolition means and looks like for you? Again, building off of what you've already talked about with mutual aid and collective organizing.
Yeah, thank you for asking. So abolition, in itself, you know, if we look back, abolition is not anything new. And, you know, I can even look into, even back to folks like Emma Goldman, who, you know, in the early 1900s would talk about prison abolition, essentially, you know, even going back to slavery, look, could you imagine if we were talking about reforming slavery instead of abolishing it? That's crazy. We needed to abolish slavery, and we did. Unfortunately, slavery found another place to go in Jim Crow, and then later in racist zoning practices where folks were excluded out of white neighborhoods. And then we look to what incarceration has done with mass incarceration. We need to totally deconstruct this system. It needs to be dismantled. Abolition means a lot of things. It means, you know, some folks are thinking that it means only, you know, getting rid of prisons and finding another way to deal with that. There are folks who say, you know, we need to get rid of policing. It's built on racist practices. If you look at the first policing, actually, I believe it was Massachusetts in 1692, there were night watches, and they were set up with young white men over the age of 18 watching for deviancy, and that could be anything from sex work or whatnot. And then in the South, we know a lot of policing started as slave patrols. Well, they've evolved, right? And I think that now it looks more like an occupying army than it is a slave patrol. And I think that abolishing policing and the way that we deal with harm is something that needs to be done as well. It doesn't mean that we don't need people to respond to harm. We just don't need occupying armies, essentially, and militarization of our schools. And it actually goes beyond borders. In February, I did an online workshop. It was a panel called In the Deadly Carceral Exchange, Advancing Abolition in Palestine and Washington State, with some other panelists named Nada Elia and Ed Hampton, and myself, and it's by the group End the Deadly Exchange Seattle, which is connected to Jewish Voice for Peace. Now, that particular group, End the Deadly Exchange Seattle, is actually aimed at getting rid of the work that Seattle Police Department is doing in exchange trips, actually, with the Israeli military. And what they're doing is they're going over to Israel and getting sort of training and technology that they're using in their colonial occupation. And they're using it here, and we're giving them some of our, you know, Seattle PD's technology and how folks are oppressed here. And the group that this is connected to, Jewish Voice for Peace, of course, is really dedicated to ending settler colonialism in Palestine. And so what we're talking about abolition goes even beyond borders. So in terms of, you know, the problem of time, we can go back to slavery in this country. And in terms of space, we're looking at not only this country, but in the world. Abolition is a huge undertaking, but it starts with one thing at a time. And I'll just say that, you know, taking on a monster that large, it can be started with one step. And No New Washington Prisons is a great example of that, because what No New Washington Prisons started was as No New Washington Women's Prisons. And there was a prison that, you know, the state wanted to build, and folks in the community said, no, no more prisons. So ending, you know, prisons as we know it, starts with just not allowing any more prisons to be built. And if we can just draw the line there and hold the line and not allow another prison to be built, then you know what, we're building, you know, we're gaining progress in the fight. So No New Washington Prisons is a great example of how we can get one victory and go from there and build momentum.
You've been listening to Outsources on KGNU Boulder, Denver, Fort Collins. I'm Sean Kenny, and we've been listening in on my conversation with Jessica Phoenix Sylvia, who called from prison to talk about her work advocating for trans rights and striving towards an abolitionist future built around collective care and concern. For more information about Jess and her work, go online to our website at news.kgnu.org and click on Outsources under the Shows and Features tab. There you can find links to Jess's website and Twitter page, in addition to information about Empowerment Avenue, the organization that helps connect outside organizations and individuals with incarcerated writers, artists, musicians, and thinkers. As always, let us know if you have comments or feedback about tonight's show by emailing outsources@kgnu.org.